At a recent White House summit for tribal nations, President Biden announced new guidance for the federal government to begin working with indigenous communities to incorporate more of their knowledge into agency research and policymaking decisions, especially on environmental issues. Indigenous observations and understanding about things like climate have been seen as an untapped resource. Biden said acknowledging their value is part of a larger federal effort to be more respectful of tribal sovereignty and authority. What could this all look like in practice? Last week, I talked to Karim Ali Kassam, International Professor of Environmental and Indigenous Studies at Cornell University. What is your reaction to this announcement, this acknowledgement from the Biden administration looking to indigenous people, indigenous knowledge as part of the effort to stop climate change?
So, first of all, my response is that this is long overdue. This needed to happen some time ago. But now that it has happened, there are a number of things we need to take into account. First and foremost, it is true, he is right, that these communities in their diverse parts of the United States have a history of living with the land and within the land, and as a result, have deep knowledge that can give us insight into the effects of climate change and potentially how to collaborate with them in responding to it. The second thing is that indigenous communities in North America or in Australia or anywhere else in the globe, in Asia, they didn't and do not contribute to climate change. And yet they are at the forefront of climate change. They are at the vanguard. So it's also a question of justice that we recognize this. And you saw that in the COP27 agreement, where they recognize the damage and loss, and they recognize that there needs to be support for adaptation. The third thing that I think that's really important to keep in mind is that given this knowledge, given the substance and the depth of it, because it is cumulative over generations, if not millennia, this knowledge should not be co-opted. You know, when government bureaucracies take over, they can calcify, they can remove the vitality, the organicness of a dynamic knowledge system of these communities. And we have a history of colonization and cultural genocide. So I'm also worried that this recognition does not lead to bureaucratization and co-opting of indigenous knowledge.
I wanted to ask you that, Karim. You've worked with communities around the world. How could, say, the Biden White House, make sure that this is an active partnership, getting concrete results as opposed to treating a community as a data set or just a symbolic outreach?
Right. So in this case, and because we claim that we are a democracy, participation is not a euphemism for taking their ideas. Participation here means scientists of different backgrounds, from climate science to ecology to social science, need to respectfully work with knowledge holders who are farmers, who are herders, who are hunters, who are fishermen, and so on, or fisher folk and orchardists. They need to work in tandem, collaboratively, and recognize that knowledge is co-generated. There is no one hero in knowledge generation. We depend on each other to build new ideas and new approaches. So that will be key: humility and mechanisms in the research process that ethically recognize and value the role of indigenous peoples as participants. And there's something else that's happening, and I can say that as a professor. Increasingly, the kids from these communities are studying at universities and are becoming scientists and leading science. So we should keep an eye out for these young people, both women and men, who also can contribute because they belong to these multiple ways of knowing, these multiple ways of thinking. And so they can be part of that process of developing solutions.
Are there examples you've seen from around the world of a successful collaboration like this between a government and an indigenous group on environmental issues, including climate change?
I think there are, if we look carefully enough, I think we will see that there are examples in the Canadian Arctic since the 1960s. We have some examples in Australia, as well as the United States and specifically in Alaska. When work began on climate change and when scientists began to explore climate change and what is happening to sea ice, they didn't have the words, nor did they have the depth of knowledge of sea ice morphology and phenology, how sea ice works, how currents and wind patterns affect sea ice. The depth and the nuanced aspect of that knowledge came from Inupiaq hunters, came from Inupiaq elders. And this informed the knowledge that climate scientists and physicists were developing in the Arctic. So there is evidence if we look. And this evidence is also borne out in our own research that we undertake in communities in the Arctic as well as in the mountain regions of Central Asia.
Yeah, in our last minute or so, can you tell us a little bit about your latest research?
So we're looking at something called ecological calendars. We have evidence that human beings have used these calendars for thousands of years. And over thousands of years, there's obviously been climate change and environmental change. And communities have been able to anticipate change, have been able to anticipate the next season, whether they are hunting communities or farming communities or fishing communities. They've been able to anticipate this change by looking at indicators in their environment, such as arrival of a migratory bird, the level of snow cover, the sound of a particular frog, the appearance of an insect, the blossoming of a tree. And they've used a sequence of these indicators to plan livelihood activities. So we're saying, yes, the Gregorian or the Julian calendar based on the sun is important, but these communities, these human communities, have developed these calendars, and we can use these calendars to anticipate change in our communities, whether we live in Manhattan or we live in the mountains of Central Asia. The issue is that how do we anticipate? What mechanisms do we use? And here, I think, indigenous knowledge, coupled with respectful institutionalized science, can work together in building this capacity. And why is this capacity so important? Well, 70 to 80% of the world's food system still depends on the small landholder, on the small farmer, on the small herder. And so places like Beijing, like Nairobi, even places like Manhattan, depend on these food producers. So not only is it the right thing to do, it's a pragmatic thing to do to protect our food systems.
Kareem, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. I hope this was helpful.
That was Kareem Ali Kassam, International Professor of Environmental and Indigenous Studies at Cornell University. I talked to him last week about a recent announcement from the Biden administration that the federal government will collaborate with Indigenous communities on research and policy decisions around things like climate change.